Good morning and welcome. My name is Ethan Womble and I'm the president of the Georgetown Law Student Chapter of the Federalist Society. If you were here with us last night, welcome back. For those of you unable to join us yesterday, welcome to the Federalist Society's 2018 National Student Symposium here at Georgetown Law. We have a very full day of events, so we'll get started right away. Here to introduce our first speaker is a man who needs no introduction in this crowd. He's a true friend of the Federalist Society, our faculty advisor for our student chapter, and the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory here at Georgetown Law, Randy Barnett.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to welcome Attorney General Sessions back to Georgetown, where he gave an address on campus free speech last September. The son of a country store owner, Mr. Sessions was born in Selma, Alabama, and grew up in High Barth, where he became an Eagle Scout. He attended Huntington College in Montgomery, Alabama, where he did something that required a good deal of courage in the 1960s. He co-founded a chapter of the Student Republicans on campus to oppose the candidacy of George Wallace for governor. He received his law degree from the University of Alabama in 1973 and served in the United States Army Reserve from 1973 to 1986, ultimately attaining the rank of captain. In 1981, he was nominated by President Reagan to serve as United States Attorney General, United States Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama, a position he held for 12 years, after which he served as the Attorney General of Alabama. From 1996 until his confirmation as Attorney General, he was United States Senator from Alabama. While I did not agree with all the policy positions he took while he was a senator, in particular his stances on civil asset forfeiture and marijuana, I have found it refreshing, a refreshing change of pace, to have an attorney general who is deeply committed to the rule of law. An attorney general who does not believe that it is the prerogative of the executive branch to take care that only the laws that he agrees with be faithfully executed. Now, any Republican attorney general worth his salt can expect to be vilified from his left. Just ask Jeff Sessions and my good friend, Ed Meese. But Attorney General Sessions has also had to withstand a good deal of, well, let's just call it friendly fire. Yet he has handled all this with dignity and restraint, the dignity and restraint that has marked his professional career. So it is my distinct privilege to welcome to the Federalist Society National Student Symposium and to Georgetown Law, the 84th Attorney General of the United States, the Honorable Jeff Sessions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Barnett, and appreciate those words. And it's good to be with you. I'm shocked that this many people showed up on Saturday morning at 8:30. And you even had a traffic jam out there. So I'm delighted to see you. I think that shows strength and vitality in the orthodox legal world. That's what I kind of think we are, and the views that we share. They're the part of the foundational, traditional views that American law was founded on, and it served us exceedingly well. And I am beyond words honored to have a small role in perhaps strengthening it, maintaining the great traditions that have been so beneficial to us. A good legal system not only is good for fairness and just plain justice, but it also is critical to prosperity and freedom and public safety. All of those things are critical. And when you travel the world, as I had the opportunity, particularly as Armed Services Committee, and see the disastrous, almost hopeless situations in so many countries around the world, you know that our great legal system, our fabulous judiciary, our traditions, our Constitution, are just beyond words, a gift that we inherited, really. We didn't produce it, and we need to maintain it and strengthen it. I'd like to express my appreciation to the Federalist Society. I saw Gene Meyer just a while ago, and I remember when it was founded and joined at some point soon after the founding. There was no chapters where I was, but I would read the publications and celebrate the fact that this organization was out there. And I concluded and said at one of their events recently, I am convinced there's no organization that seeks to advance an interest that's been more effective in the last 30 years to achieve the goals it set than the Federalist Society. Don't you agree? I just think it's fabulous. And the great judges that are being nominated now, they'll serve for hopefully years to come, who believe in classical American law. I think it's just fabulous what you're doing, and I appreciate it. So our founders set up a great system in which the Congress writes laws. They're elected. The executive branch carries out the laws, and the judiciary applies those to cases and controversies that come before them. But you know well that there's always a serious risk that each branch might overreach in its powers, but I guess we're talking about potential overreach by the judiciary this morning. Judges have limited powers. For example, we had recently a judge tell one of our fine lawyers in court, well, you can't, quote, you can't come into court to espouse a position so heartless. Now, that just hurt my heart to have my fine attorney attacked in court. I didn't appreciate it, frankly, but it didn't say it was illegal, the position we were taking. In fact, it was in fact legal, and it wasn't unlawful, but it was heartless, he said. So I think it was at the Federalist Society. I said publicly that it wasn't his job to decide what was heartless, but the American people, through their representatives, pass laws, and we try to enforce them as they're written, and that was our responsibility. And the same judge then said, back in court to, I guess, my lawyers, that I seem to think that courts can't have an opinion. Well, that's wrong, of course. Judges should issue opinions, legal opinions, that pertain to the legal questions before them as part of the case and not to politics or sentiment. As Attorney General, I have been shocked, really, by the actions of certain judges and courts that we've dealt with who are failing to respect the constitutional responsibilities of the executive and the legislative branches. These branches are co-equal. The court is not superior. The court does not get to have the final word in every dispute. Give me a break. All courts are empowered to decide specific cases and controversies, but they do not have every word. On matters of policy, the branches that are directly accountable to the people, and I've been there, I had to be accountable, must be given their proper respect. The new vehicle that we're seeing today, and I'd like to talk to you about, that's being used by activist judges to direct executive policy and functioning is the issuing of nationwide injunctions, orders that block the entire United States government from enforcing an executive branch policy or carrying out a legislative statute. And it's just not in one district. They issue orders that apply nationwide, and not just to parties before the court, but to everybody throughout the country. So the courts have been calling them nationwide injunctions. Well, I think that's true, but it would be fitting to call them non-party injunctions or limitless injunctions, since they bind all of America and grant relief to those who are not parties to the case. And they are usually preliminary injunctions, so they block important government actions before a trial has occurred. So if you think about it, that's a pretty august power. One judge can do this. Scholars have not found a single example of any judge issuing this type of extreme remedy in the first 175 years of the Republic. Now, President Trump, he's been hit with 22 in just over 1 year in office on issues like DACA, or the travel order, or sanctuary cities, or the service of transgender people in the military. We've carefully worked on these matters. We believe we've soundly evaluated them, and the orders are lawful and defensible, but boom, one judge, no, nationwide. So while you may have heard differently, we believe that our actions are justified, the orders that have been issued are lawful, and within the powers of the chief executive. We're eager to defend these actions before the Supreme Court and actually are confident about our prospects. In fact, the Supreme Court has already issued, I don't know if you've noticed this, three extraordinary opinions by which they essentially have reversed the vast majority of the injunctions on the travel matter and have granted extraordinary writ of mandamus to stop a district court judge's extreme discovery order. They were deposing my counsel. They don't usually depose the counsel in the case. One of my counsel being deposed, and we got finally, the United States Supreme Court issued an order to stop it in the middle of a deposition. So we are feel like, in many instances, a lot of these actions are outside proper law. I just have to tell you, that's the way we see it. It's hard enough to manage the colossal government of the United States under the laws passed by Congress. Give me a break, that's pretty hard. But much less when you're facing a host of nationwide injunctions imposed by just one of 600 federal judges, injunctions that really do cause turmoil and disruption. It took more than 200 years for the first 22 nationwide injunctions to be issued. Now we've had 22 in just 1 year. Clearly something has changed. It's not as though there weren't legal controversies before 1963. There were indeed many. They were hotly contested, but nobody issued nationwide limitless injunctions. In 1897, in Scott versus Donald, for example, the Supreme Court found a law unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court did, and even recognized that many others beside the plaintiff before them were entitled to relief, but the court issued an injunction that only prevented the application of the law to that plaintiff. And during the New Deal controversies, courts concluded that one new tax was unconstitutional more than 1,600 times. They issued more than 1,600 injunctions, but each of those injunctions applied only to the plaintiff before the court, and the government collected the tax in good faith from more than 71,000 taxpayers before the Supreme Court eventually struck it down. In truth, there is a question that we're dealing with, and I feel it more, I think, than even the lawyers in the Department of Justice, because I was in the legislature, the Senate, and now as Attorney General. It's a question often of pure raw power. Who decides? Who has the authority? And these are policy questions for the most part. Our elected representatives, our elected president, or unelected, lifetime appointed federal judges. This is a serious matter, and it bears on the very effectiveness of representative democracy. So today, in effect, single district court judges are going beyond proper adjudicated bounds, making themselves super legislators for the entire United States. That means that each of the more than 600 federal district judges in the United States can enjoin a law or regulation throughout the country, regardless of whether the other 599 agree. These limitless injunctions are contrary to the structure of our government, to the role of our judiciary, and they hamper or even block the proper functioning of our government. And importantly, they dramatically undermine the power of the people to control their government. So let me share a few concerns about it. First of all, The nationwide injunctions encourage forum shopping, right? There's a reason why so many lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration in California or Hawaii, to which I once referred to as that island in the middle of the Pacific, which is, so far as I can tell, accurate, deemed offensive by some. And it's why others were filed in Texas against the Obama administration. Look, litigants are looking for the most favorable forum, right, in which to advance their goal of binding the nation to advance their agenda. Virtually, it's always to secure, is it not, a policy outcome that could never be won at the ballot box or in the legislature. So second, limitless injunctions cut off discussion among the lower courts. This is pretty odd to me. We know that the first court to rule on an issue isn't always right. We've seen that historically. Our federal judicial system is set up so that district courts in different parts of the country consider same issues and rule on them. Those issues may be appealed to one of the 12 circuits. When those circuit courts disagree, then the Supreme Court would normally undertake review. Non-party injunctions short-circuit the system. The federal government is forced to appeal the first nationwide injunction, possibly all the way to the Supreme Court, 18 months perhaps in the process. The effect is to cut off the opportunities for other courts to weigh in, and often these are preliminary injunctions, meaning a full case record has not been developed before the vast scope of the injunction directs the policy of the United States government. Third, when a single district judge issues a nationwide injunction while similar cases are pending elsewhere, the first ruling by the first district judge somehow becomes authoritative. While if they enter an injunction, and while contrary rulings by equally authoritative district judges don't have an effect, they just don't count. A telling example of this is the litigation over the rescission of the DACA policy. Parties have sued in several courts across the country, meaning that several judges are considering the issue and will issue rulings that should be binding only on the plaintiff before them, normally. Yet a federal judge in San Francisco and a federal judge in New York both felt they had the authority to issue a nationwide injunction granting relief to others who were not parties to the case. Then, last week, a federal judge in Maryland held that the DACA rescission was lawful. So the plaintiffs in the Maryland case lost, but by the rulings of the San Francisco and New York judges, they got their relief anyway. Fourth, limitless injunctions circumvent the class certification process required by statute and by Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This is akin to a class action, these injunctions. That's because they provide the benefits of class certification without the procedural protections of class certification. Fifth, limited injunctions create an absurd situation in which a plaintiff only needs to win once to stop a national law from taking effect or a national policy. But the government needs to win every time to carry out its policies. That makes governing all but impossible. You could lose five straight cases, or the plaintiffs could, that seek to enjoin the government from executing a certain policy, and then the fifth judge rules that the injunction is in force, and it is in force even in those cases, districts where the judges ruled otherwise. My predecessor, the great Attorney General Robert Jackson, faced a similar problem, later justice. In 1937, he lamented that, quote, this is pretty, I like this quote, no administration can halt its policies to seek the judiciary's views. The government cannot learn the judge's views until after the law is passed, and then only after a lapse of years. Moreover, the judicial contribution is always negative. It may tell what cannot be done, but it never tells the government what can be done. Government, by litigation, has destroyed effective enforcement of public policy. I kind of feel that way sometimes. He didn't know how good he had it, however. So, the Department of Justice has been fighting the unprecedented number of limitless injunctions in the courts, and we're well aware of what's at stake. For example, last year I made the common sense decision that our state and local law enforcement grants that go to cities and states should go to those who actually cooperate with us in federal law enforcement, these discretionary grants, and including the enforcement of immigration laws, not requiring states and cities to participate in any way, but asking for certain limited cooperation. So we ask that to receive this grant money, jurisdictions need to certify that they comply with existing federal law, barring restrictions on communications between state and local agencies. This is really important. Our ICE officers, our federal officers, we coordinate with each other every day. Detainers are issued every day between cities and states and counties and federal government. And we honor that routinely. And it's just one of the most sophisticated improvements in law enforcement in America. It's gotten better and better, and it's essential because people are so mobile today. We ask that they allow ICE agents access to detention facilities, which we do routinely in non-immigration cases, to meet with the aliens and to inquire into his or her right to remain in the United States. And third, we ask that they provide notice of 48 hours before they intend to release an alien who's been convicted of a crime, who's being held in the state jail. These are small but important requests for cooperation. And we think if we're going to send out federal money, we ought to send it out primarily to people who help us do our jobs and enforce federal law. So this allows ICE to know when the aliens are arrested and can decide whether or not to take custody of them. These are aliens who have committed crimes or are suspected of committing crimes. They are serious enough criminals that the local governments, even San Francisco, may have arrested them and put them in the slammer. And yet some cities think only their law enforcement interests deserve vindication and not those of the federal government. And why then should we provide them grant money? They're not going to at least be minimally cooperative. Well, unsurprisingly, several of these cities have sued us. They don't like this. They think they're entitled to this money anyway. They don't want federal law or to comply with the most reasonable cooperative requirements. And so, sure enough, the first city to the courthouse, Chicago, found a local judge who agreed with them. We disagree with the merits of that ruling, and we think we will ultimately prevail on the legal question. But normally this would be a discrete error or discrete decision affecting only one city's grant. And we would correct it on appeal in due course. Wouldn't impact the whole country, but instead of issuing an injunction for that city, the judge enjoined the federal government from imposing these conditions on any state or city across the entire nation, including those that agree completely with our position and support us and don't want this relief. So what possible interest does Chicago have in such a sweeping relief? The litigants for the city of Chicago, they have an interest in their grant, but they're not empowered represent parties around the country that don't want their representation. What possible interest do they have in this? So Chicago's only plausible interest is its grant money, and that would have been completely vindicated. Their protections would have been vindicated by a ruling involving Chicago in that district judge. Meanwhile, other judges are considering it, the same question. A judge in San Francisco recently denied a preliminary injunction to that city, but it doesn't matter because a judge in Chicago has already decided to give relief to every city, including San Francisco, and it trumps their decision. By not acting as a district court of limited jurisdiction, the Chicago judge has halted the grant process for the entire country. And people, these cities and counties, are getting anxious. That months are going by, and money they expected to receive is not going out. And so we now are, you know, trying to seek expedited relief, expedited appeal to the Seventh Circuit. And it just takes time. Months go by, and cities and counties expected their grant money. Cooperative cities and counties, a vast majority of them, are being held up. The increasing frequency of limitless injunctions is simply unsustainable. And the ever more extreme nature of some of these injunctions is only making it more obvious just how unconstitutional they are. The Supreme Court has not yet issued a definitive ruling on the merits of nationwide injunctions. They've not done so. So far, when the court has had relevant cases before it, they have resolved those cases on other grounds. But we are hopeful that the Supreme Court will soon send a clear message to the lower courts that injunctions ought to be limited to the parties in the case. Scope of relief is at issue in a number of high-profile cases right now. We will soon be arguing the merits of the president's travel ban, and we've asked for a review of this aspect of the case as well. We think it will be before the Supreme Court. It's not a political or partisan issue. Really, it's not. It is a constitutional issue and a rule of law issue. This has been a problem for the administrations of both parties. Until President Trump, the president with the most limitless injunctions was President Obama, and President Clinton was in second place. But the Department of Justice, under Democrat and Republican administrations alike, including the Obama administration, has been consistent over the past several decades that nationwide injunctions gravely threaten the rule of law. They threaten the proper respect for separation of powers and, indeed, the very functioning of the other two branches of our government. The American people vote for those other two branches of government. In case you haven't heard from your TV ads, people have to campaign and seek support for the policies they want to further. And the people want their votes to count. They want their voices heard. The political branches need to be able to function and to be able to carry out reasonable constitutional policies. So this is my message. We hope the Supreme Court will resolve the issue. There can be no question that courts should put an end to nationwide injunctions and keep activists on both sides of the aisle from paralyzing the functioning of our government. In order for our system to work, the court must end government by litigation. I'm hopeful they soon will, and that with your help and the intellectual support of persons like you, we'll be able to restore the rule of law in our country. Thank you. It's great to be with you this morning. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. My name is Darina Merriam, and I'm a Georgetown Law student and the symposium chair this year. We have just a few brief questions for you from our audience, and I know everyone here would truly appreciate your insight on those questions. So I'm now going to read the first question, which is, how do you justify increased use of civil asset forfeiture under the limited government model?
Asset forfeiture has been the law for 60 years. At least it has been actively utilized for 60 years. It's been before the Supreme Court multiple times. One of the first things you want to do if you're fighting an illegal enterprise is not let them keep the profits from the unlawful enterprise. Under the President Reagan and the Department of Justice, we really improved the functioning of asset forfeiture. It takes probable cause for a police officer who apprehends someone he believes, usually it's a drug dealer, that he believes is violating the law, probable cause to seize $50,000 they may have in their car. And a police officer, 21 years old, can arrest the mayor and put him in jail for probable cause. Indictments are returned on probable cause. So we think there's every right to seize illegal profits. They're part of the law of the country. It's been repeatedly upheld. It arises out of the English system. It's an action in rem, and it's not against the person. It doesn't deny a person of their liberty, and then they're promptly given the right to contest that forfeiture. And we've required our lawyers, I've taken a number of steps, because I've heard the complaints about it. And so we did a couple of several things. First, I picked a experienced, proven attorney, and I told him I want this system working properly. If there are any problems, let me know. We want to fix them at the earliest stage. We require our attorneys to file their answers at half the time the law requires them so a person can get the hearing sooner. But by the way, in the drug cases, which are overwhelmingly what we deal with, 80% of those cases aren't even contested, because where'd you get $50,000 in cash under the seat of your car? They used to say, I got it gambling, you know, but now the casinos record if you won $50,000, and you can check that. So, you know, people figure perjuring themselves in a losing cause isn't worth the contest. So I think the system works well. It's a huge matter for state and local law enforcement, I think it's a proven process.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. The next question from our audience is the following. What is the Justice Department doing to enforce the federal marijuana laws?
Well, we're not going to be able, even if we desired, to take over state enforcement of routine cases that might occur. Federal agents are highly paid, highly trained, and they work on cases involving cartels, international organizations, major distribution networks, large amounts of cash, and they deal with criminal organizations, RICO-type cases, and we're not out there prosecuting those cases every day. But it is the law of the United States of America. And the law of the United States of America, in case you haven't heard, applies in every state in the United States. And I am not going to tell Colorado or California or someone else that the possession of marijuana is legal under United States law. I don't think it's healthy either. If I were sick, I wouldn't suggest you take marijuana to cure yourself. I'm not sure it's proven to be particularly helpful. So that's kind of where we are on that. I've sent out a memo that reversed the Cole Memorandum of the Department of Justice. I believe it's a rule of law question. I think the Cole Memorandum basically conceded, and was perceived to have conceded at least, that states have the ability to determine marijuana policy in their states, and federal law was of very limited effect. I think that was incorrect legally. So we just simply withdrew the Cole Memorandum. We tell our U.S. attorneys to use your resources as you feel best. They haven't been working small marijuana cases before, and they're not going to be working them now. If it comes up as a part of a bigger case, a criminal enterprise, a lot of it's being done on federal lands and park lands and doing destruction to our park system. Those are the kind of things that I'm sure each one of those U.S. attorneys will decide how to handle.
Thank you. Our next question is the following. Do you think it was a mistake to recuse yourself from the Russian investigation?
No, I don't.
It's not my question.
You know, what did you say? No, I think that's what I had to do. I did not realize, I knew you have to deal with those questions, and I told the confirmation committee that I would consult with top officials in the department about any recusal issue. But there is a specific regulation that says if you participate in a campaign, it explicitly says that, then you can investigate the campaign of which you were a part. Pretty reasonable thing. And I was chairman of the National Security Committee of the Trump campaign and participated in it. So I didn't feel like it was, and that was what I was advised by the professionals, career people in the department, and I felt like I had to recuse myself.
Thank you. And our last question for you, how does the Department of Justice decide whether to participate in a case before the Supreme Court?
Well, I asked Noel Francisco, there's my Solicitor General down here, a good Federalist Society member, and he tells me what to do.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
No, we've got a great group in there in the Solicitor General's office. A lot of career people. So we evaluated on a lot of issues, like, is this the best case to bring up? So this case may be marginal. You know, it may not be the best factual basis to create a clear issue for the Supreme Court that would likely result in a ruling that we think is proper. And so it takes a lot of thought that goes into that. And it takes people who know the court, know their tendencies, know the makeup of the court, and who's familiar with the history and growth of the law in a lot of different areas. And it's no little matter to decide what to take before the Supreme Court. And so the Solicitor General, you know, that's the greatest lawyer job in the world. You get to stand before the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, represent the greatest country in the history of the world, the United States of America. It's quite an honor, Noel, and he is a fabulous addition to our office.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. We know we have a busy schedule ahead of you, so thank you for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you all. Thank you.